So first of all, let me thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to present this work that Wyeth and I have been doing in Stockholm. Using a combination of independent methods, we tried to develop a predictive model for regulatory sequences directing liver-specific transcription. And this work was done at Karolinska in Stockholm. To a large part, this work is very much analogous to previous studies of muscle-specific regions by Wyeth, together with Jim Fickett. That was done in 98, and I've given the PubMed ID here instead of the literature reference. And I thought it's maybe also useful because there might be one or two people in the audience who are not familiar with this literature resource. So it's managed by the National Center for Biological Information. And when you go to this website and follow the link to PubMed, you just have to enter this ID, and then what you get is the abstract and the journal reference. And in many cases, you can access the full text of the article. Now, what's the motivation for this work? Why are we studying liver-specific regulatory regions? As was demonstrated in earlier talks, mainly by Gary Stomo and by Peter von Hippel in his talk, this whole business of understanding transcriptional regulation is very complicated. Now, our approach is to restrict ourselves to a rather small subset of genes and try to learn from available experimental data enough so that we're able to develop a model that is maybe dramatically simplified compared to these pictures we saw with distal enhancers cooperating in some pretty much unknown way with promoters and even intronic regulatory elements and switching on and off genes. So our model is very much simplified, but I will show you later on, it has relevance for predictions that are restricted to the subset of genes that we use for the development of our model. So this simplification that we're doing is the reason why also these pictures look dramatically simplified compared to pictures we saw earlier on gene regulation. So in Peter von Hippel's words, this would be the zeroth approximation we're looking at, not the first approximation. But what we're interested in is studying the instructions that are hidden somewhere in the human genome and switch genes on or off. And as it turns out, these on-off switches for genes consist of groups of transcription factors that bind to sets of regulatory regions. Those regulatory regions can be within genes. If they're within genes, they're mostly within the first intron, or they can be adjoining genes in the promoter, or they can be far upstream, a few thousand base pairs upstream relative to the transcription start site. Now, one work to avoid confusion with semantics, the way Nick was using the words regions and modules, he was distinguishing between regions and modules within those regions. Now, what I call regions here, supposed to mean modules in his language. So these, what I'm going to call regulatory regions, are regions that are more on the order of 100 base pairs long than on the order of 1,000 base pairs long. And I just made a claim that is very strong about these groups of transcription factors binding to regions that are of a more or less well-defined length. Now let me go ahead and confirm this claim by showing you a few examples that we collected from the literature. And actually, these examples that I'm showing you here are a part of our data set that we used for the construction of our quantitative model. Now, you see a lot of triangles and squares and other symbols. Let me go through this in some more detail. What you can see on the left of those two columns, maybe here and here, are the official names for these genes that these regions belong to. These are called the Hugo symbols, and those are only valid for human genes. And if we are looking at some other orthologs here, then we use the Hugo symbol of the human ortholog. In the next column, you see the species we're looking at. We have HS for Homo sapiens, and these R's and M's denote different mouse and rat strains. And then we have transcription factors, illustrated by different symbols, binding, as you can see, mostly in cooperation, except for this one example, within a region whose boundaries with respect to the transcription of start site are denoted by these numbers here. Yes, all these genes we're looking at are liver specific, and this is. I'm gonna come to that in a second. So this is something without any prior knowledge we could have taken from the literature by going to PubMed, typing in liver specific and transcription. Then we would have gotten several thousand, and I did this, the several thousand. Articles that we have to go through and see if we can extract information about binding sites of the factors and also information about the boundaries of the regions from the literature. Now, you don't want to go through tens of thousands of articles. Yeah, Terry?
So they're taking from two different regions?
No, I'm gonna say something. We have more than three genes here. We have one, two, three, and then we have four more genes, and altogether we have about something on the order of 20.
But
all different genes. These things here in the first column, these are the symbols for different genes. For example, this aldolase, aldo B stands for aldolase B, and this is Homo sapiens. These are human. HS stands for Homo sapiens, and then R and M for the rat and mouse strains. So just by collecting data from the literature, you get this kind of information. You can put it into some kind of annotated FASTA-like file or something like that. And now there are two very important observations we can make looking at these triangles and squares and ellipses and so. One of them is that these regulatory regions seem to have a more or less well-defined length. We don't see regulatory regions that are 2,000 base pairs long. We see something that is, well, for example, from plus 2,125 to plus 2,329, this would be a region that is far downstream.
There
can be other regions, but this is one what is annotated in the literature as regulatory region, something that has an is functional in vivo for gene regulation. This is very important.
So you can allow from this site downstream, it will not function as vivo specificity.
Sorry?
You can allow from this site downstream, it will restore the vivo specificity.
Exactly, absolutely. This is the kind of experimental work we were looking at. So these are all regulatory regions that we extracted from the literature, and from the literature we see that they made deletion experiments and things like that, that it destroyed the function in vivo of these genes. And they can occur, because that was one of my claims I made before, they can occur in the promoter, as in this example of CYP7A, that's one gene that's involved in the metabolism of cholesterol to bile acids. Or we can have them in the intron, like as here for example, or here, an intronic element, or it can be far upstream, as here in this example. So the well-definedness of the size of the region is one important observation that it's very important for the construction of our model. So looking at these numbers here, you will hopefully agree with me that it is somewhat reasonable to make a model that says, well, these regions are 200 base pairs long. And then you can go ahead and see how reasonable your results are you're looking at. And certainly this is one point of further refinement, but it is not entirely silly to make this assumption. This is the point I had to make. Yes, please. Oh yeah, exactly. I was going to mention that in a second. Yeah, I was going to mention that in a second. So one observation that I already discussed briefly is the well-definedness of the length of the region. The other important, and this is in agreement with the opinion of experts on this subject, as for example Arnone and Davidson. Nick gave the reference before. It's one of the papers we like to refer to when we talk about these modules. And the other important observation we can make is that we have, apart from some examples, we have some exceptions. We have essentially a handful of factors that are critical for liver specificity of these genes. And this is also in agreement with what you can find in the books and papers written by the experts. And one or two articles I want to quote is one by Joe Locker and another one by Gretchen Darlington. I haven't included the reference here, but you can have it later on if you're interested. And those factors that are usually referred to as liver critical are these three HNF factors and this factor C, EBP. SP1 is one transcription factor that is an example for, you know, a factor that is occurring here and there, but is in general not considered to be liver critical. And these three HNFs, I should mention, they belong to different protein families, but because they are involved in liver-specific transcriptional regulation, important for liver-specific transcriptional regulation, they are put together under this acronym hepatocyte nuclear factors. Okay, so there are these two main observations that we made. One of them was the size of the region, and the other one that we have in general a cooperative working of a handful of transcription factors, to be more precise, four. And there are exceptions, and this is related to the question you had before. This is one example for only one factor acting in the critical way, switching a gene on or off. And therefore, we included this in our data collection as a regulatory region, even though it's only one factor that's acting. It will hopefully become clearer when I show you the next transparency why it's actually consistent with the construction of our model, that it's not one of the other factors, but this one, maybe HNF1, that acts alone. It has to do with the specificity of this particular transcription factor. Okay, so before we go ahead and try to construct the liver-specific model based on sites for all those four factors together acting cooperatively, we want to look at the individual factors. And I'm going to go through this only very briefly because this has been shown to you in a similar way already before. For example, when Gary Stomer was talking here about 10 days ago or so. What we're doing as the next step is that we take our collection of experimentally determined binding sites and we construct predictive matrices to score potential binding sites using a standard approach by collecting from the collection of binding sites we construct count matrices, convert those trivially to frequency matrices, and then essentially we do a log odds rescaling of those frequency matrices, and what we arrive at are position-specific weight matrices, or some people call those profiles, some other people call them position-specific scoring matrices. If you talk to people like Michael Gripskov or Tim Bailey, for example, they would use this PSSM abbreviation. Here in these pictures, I illustrate the position weight matrices, or that characterize the binding sites, as position-specific sequence logos that depict the position-specific Shannon information content at each position. The height of these letters, of the stacks of letters, gives you the information content, and the ratios of the different sizes give you the relative frequencies of the letters. And one observation you can make from looking at those four different logos is that the information content for HNF1 and HNF4 is higher than for the two other factors that we include in our model, and you see EBP and HNF1. And this is, to come back to your question from before, when you remember this one region that had only the one HNF1 binding site, yeah, it was this ellipse, this blue one, that was HNF1. And HNF1 has a rather high information content, so it seems to be reasonable. I would have been more surprised, let's put it this way, if we had found a single very critical binding site for one of these two weaker factors.
Okay. The sites you showed before, those were experimentally determined.
Yes.
Yeah. If you find lots of one site, just scan along the sequence. These are ones that were actually demonstrated.
Yes. Yeah, right. And from this collection of experimental data, that we started with, we constructed matrices, and this what I'm showing you here, except for CEBP, for certain technical reasons I'm not going to discuss, these are logos that are constructed from our collection of binding sites that we aligned with Gibbs sampling, and you go through all these computational little steps and you arrive at this, and we compare those against the matrices you can find when you go to TransFAC or TESS, and looked at the agreement between those. For each matrix? How many examples for different matrices? Oh, about, that's a slight variation, about 25 or 30. I mean, this was quite painful work, and at some point, I mean, it was good to have somebody who enters the field like me being exposed to the vast literature of molecular biology and to have to go through the papers. I mean, in some sense, it was a learning process that was good to go through. And so for each of those factors, we included something on the order of 25 different binding sites.
Coming multiple sets, or?
That's a very good question. In the regulatory regions, you mean? Okay. Yeah.
Pick one protein.
Yeah.
Maybe you show some picture that has two. Mm-hmm. Most of them have at least two or three.
No. It is very hard to establish rules, and it is true that when you look at the examples I showed you before, together with the others I left out because I didn't want to expose you to all the collection we have, then it is very interesting to observe that the weaker factors tend to occur at multiple positions within the region, or tend to occur more often at multiple positions compared to the stronger factors. And even for the stronger factors, there are thoughts about factors, a factor like HNF1, for example, that's really strong compared to the others, binding to a position where its own binding might be weaker, but where the synergy effect to bind together with other, to cooperate with other factors might be improved. This is a very interesting thought. Yeah, so, but we're looking at, as I said before, a drastically simplified model, because what I want to show you in hopefully not too far, in the not too distant future from now, in something like 15 minutes maybe, are results where we scan the whole human, well, what's available from human genome using our model and arrive at results. And, you know, and later on what we want to do is we have to go back and carefully consider all the steps we made and consider improvements. And one of them is this point of, you know, looking at multiple sites. Okay, now, if we were to base our model on the individual binding of these transcription factors, we wouldn't get very far. And this is true not only for these rather unspecific factors, but even if we look at HNF1 or HNF4, because of the relationship between the information content of this binding site and the predicted site frequency, if we were to scan a large number of sequences using just individual matrices and looking at the predictions, we would get predicted sites all over the place. I'm going to show you what that means in a second. I just want to give you this reference here of the paper that was written by Tom Schneider and Gary Stomo and Ehrenfeucht and Gold. I think that's everybody who was involved. From 86, if you want to read something like the classical paper on these issues here. If you take the individual weight matrices for these factors and go ahead and scan some unknown sequence for potential regulatory regions, this is pretty much what you get. So this is some sequence, I forgot which one it was, I selected it randomly, it doesn't matter here. What I want to show you is that you have a sequence here is 0, and here is 4,500, and these are predicted binding sites for each of the factors, and I've chosen the cutoff of the weight, you know, the total range of the weight matrix to be 70%. 70% between the minimum and the maximum value you can achieve with that individual weight matrix. And so what you see is that you get too many sites. It is shown in experimental work, there's one paper by François Tronche, for example, that one might look at in this connection. There is experimental work that shows that if you do these kind of predictions for HNF1, for example, you can show that the protein in vitro binds to that particular position in that particular sequence, but it doesn't tell you anything about functional relevance of these binding sites. So in order to to find a remedy of this problem. What we can try to do is to somehow combine the scores of the individual position weight matrices and construct a method that allows us to score potential regulatory regions. So in other words, we want to combine the individual scores for the weight matrices and compute a number that tells us, if we scan some unknown sequence, wow, this is a very good candidate for regulatory region. Or it tells us, forget about it. No way. This is oversimplified, and things are not as beautiful, but this would be the ideal case. We want to distinguish between regulatory regions and no regulatory regions. And the method that we've chosen to achieve this goal is logistic regression. Logistic regression is a probabilistic method that allows you to distinguish, to classify objects into two distinct classes. These two distinct classes are typically modeled by a binary outcome variable. Let's call this binary outcome variable y, 0 and 1 for the two distinct classes. And this binary outcome variable in turn is modeled by the logistic function, therefore the name logistic regression. What are we doing? We are looking at 200 base pair training sequences. If you remember what I've showed you before, the experimental evidence suggests that it is not absolutely stupid to make the assumption that regulatory regions have a length of 200 base pairs. We're taking positive training sequences, those are the experimentally verified regulatory regions, and we're taking negative training examples. Those are chosen randomly from a data collection that was used before for similar work. The critical point were the positive training sequences that we had to collect from the literature here. And we identify the best scoring site for each of those four transcription factors, for HNF1, HNF3, HNF4, and CEBP. And then these maximum scores within the 200 base pair region form a... Sorry?
What do you mean by best scoring?
Oh, you can take the position weight matrix within the 200 base pair sequence and go through it and then look at the best scoring site for each of the factors.
So you need a relative. You could have defined this 200 by shifting by 10.
No, it's a 200 base pair training sequence we're looking at. These guys I showed you before with different triangles and squares in them.
So the coordinate of, let's say, the square is at 10.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
You could have shifted.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, it's somewhat arbitrary way we set the boundaries. And very often, it's when you look into the literature, it's not as easy as, you know, it's not exactly 200, and they should have different weights from the experimental relevance people gathered. But this was fine. The information we got was fine enough. Sorry?
And we have multiple.
This is one thing that we leave for the future. We're only looking at the best hit for each factor. This is a simplification that has to be revised in the future, definitely. Okay, so the best scores form a 4D vector, and then the regression procedure is used to determine the coefficient for each transcription factor to fit the logistic function to that. Now, let's look at the 1D toy model just to illustrate a little bit what this method is doing. And for those people who maybe want to look at this from the neural network point of view, this whole logistic regression thing is nothing else but a very simple neural network with one input and one output layer, no hidden layer. And you have as the activation function, the logistic function, and your energy function is the Goldberg Leibler distance.
What's the
logistic function? The logistic function is this thing here, that's what's usually referred to as the solution of the logistic equation. This, you know, when you have not exponential growth, but it's a function that has the sigmoid form. So there are papers that show the equivalence of this method with this neural network I just described briefly. But let me show you in this one dimensional toy model that, you know, we assume we have only one transcription factor, because it's hard to draw a 4+1 dimensional picture. What we have is a collection of training sequences. These are our 200 base pair negative training sequences. we look at the maximal score of our one transcription factor in our one-dimensional toy model, and we draw the score on this axis, and we have all zeros because those were negative training sequences. The positive training sequences, those are the experimentally verified liver-specific regulatory regions, are all at one, and the scores are here. And then what we do is we fit this function here to the data using a maximum likelihood method. This is what is, well, an example for 1D logistic regression. And the result looks something like this, the logistic function. Oh, it is. Sorry, we have chosen this function because it is a method that people have gathered quite a lot of experience with in applying it to problems where you have to discriminate between two sets. There are other possibilities. This is only one possible choice that we have chosen to a large part for mathematical convenience.
What is going on? What is classified according to? It's classified according to what?
According to score. What we want to do is the way we want to apply this method is we want to take, and this is the use, what I described here. What you want to do is you want to take a 200 base pair window, because we make the assumption that regulatory regions have a length of 200 base pairs. We want to slide this over an unknown sequence, and then at each position we want to use the scores of the transcription factors in order to compute a number. And this number here is given by the value of this red curve at the position of the score. And then, based on this number, we know about the probability that this 200 base pair window represents a regulatory region or not. And in our case, we have to look at a four-dimensional problem, take the four best scores for those four different transcription factors, and then we compute a number that's between 0 and 1.
This example looks like it's trying to do some spatial separation.
Sir?
Is it trying to draw some domain
boundaries
to make some spatial separation?
No. If we take a site that has good binding for the liver factors, we will get a number that we will get a high score here. We're on the far right of this model, or far out in this four-dimensional plane here, and then we get a number that's closer to 1. So we're more likely to look at a regulatory region.
So it turns out our data parameter such that the likelihood of observing this data set is maximized.
Yes, that's the training.
If it's randomly distributed, you'll get a flat line.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And after training the parameters, and well, for technical reasons, I should also mention this will be an inner product because beta will be four-dimensional, and x, the best scores in this 200 region. 200 base pair region will be four-dimensional. And then we slide this 200 base pair window over a sequence, and we get a number between 0 and 1. We have to establish a threshold that we have chosen to be 0.25 for reasons that were motivated by the fact that we made the assumption that we have one regulatory region about every 35,000 base pairs, which translates to taking the old-fashioned view that the human genome has 100,000 genes, about one regulatory region per gene. But this is somewhat adjustable, this threshold. But we've chosen this threshold to be 0.25, and let me now show you an example of the way this is used. This method. We take a 200 base pair window, a window from 0 to 200 at the leftmost position. Then we look for the best scores of the four critical liver factors, and we write down the number. We move it a little bit, 5 base pairs or 10 base pairs, so look at the best scoring sites for the four factors, write down the number again, and so on until we're all the way through.
Multiple factors, you just multiply 5 functions together?
Sorry?
For multiple factors, you multiply the 5
No, it's this inner product thing that I said, that I mentioned. Let me go back. You have only one pi function for the four decays, but this beta times x will be an inner product between a four-dimensional vector beta and a four-dimensional vector x. And then the probability to measure y equals 1 based on x is given by this expression, well, which will be just pi to the y. All right? Yeah, exactly. So, and those are five nonlinear equations. Well, you can even use Maple or something like that for that. We used a package called Octave, which is GNU freely available, and we liked it. It was beautiful. Okay, now let's look at this case where we take the 200 base pair window, slide it over the sequence, and write down the number. Now, in this case, this is the human selenoprotein P genomic sequence, just upstream exon 1. We get something where that I denoted with a question mark. A question mark because, well, this might be a regulatory region. This is a number that's well above our threshold, but still we have to deal with false positives. And if you have a sequence that doesn't go only from 0 to 1,800, but one that goes all the way from here to, let's say, the beachside cafe or so, you have to look at very many, possibly false positives. So it would be very good, even though results like this suggest the presence of regulatory regions, it would be very good to have supportive evidence for the presence of regulatory regions. And as Nick already said, the key point of the method we're using to provide this supportive evidence, namely phylogenetic footprinting, is that regulatory regions tend to have a higher level of conservation than other non-coding segments. So we combine the method, this green curve, with a curve that I've drawn with red color that shows you the level of sequence similarity. What is shown here on the pictures? Let's focus on this picture here on the upper left. You see a green curve, that's the liver score that we got by sliding our 200 base pair window over the sequence and getting this number between 0 and 1. And there's this one peak that you see that has a score of 0.6, even better than the one before. A very good candidate for liver-specific region if we don't know anything about the sequence. Now, what the x-axis shows you is the position with respect to this human gene, CYP7A, that you can access with this accession number. And what the red curve shows you is the DBA score. DBA is a program that is used for comparing conservation between regulatory regions. I have given a reference down here if you're interested. What the red curve shows you now is the similarity between the human sequence and the rat sequence. And now you see these rectangles here, here, and here. And when you look at the level of conservation, how many percent similarity you have within those blocks. There's one block that you can see here. When you look at the details of what DBA gives you as a result, shows you that you have more than 75% sequence similarity. And this is not very surprising, because when you look into the annotations, then you see that you have exons here, here, and here, and where you have this green peak, there's actually an experimentally verified regulatory region. And we're a little bit cheating here because, not really cheating, but this is not surprising because CYP7A, this region that I depicted with a blue triangle, was in fact a training sequence that we used for the development of our model. So at least this is consistent with, shows some consistency of our method. Right? And this is exactly the kind of supportive evidence we're looking for. We want to have a high signal in our model that scores liver specificity, that knows about liver specificity, and we want to have a high score of another method that is independent, that measures sequence conservation between species. And if we get high signals in both, then we're in a better shape than if we just look at one example of our liver score. Let me, instead of looking here on the upper right, let me give you this example here where we have a similar situation. We have three those gray boxes denoting exons, and we have a blue triangle showing a regulatory region, and we're in a very good shape again because we have a high level of sequence conservation and a high level signal in this region here where we have a regulatory region. But in fact, this is a demonstration of a failure of our model, because when we look into the literature, at this sequence, we see that we have a regulatory region here that involves an HNF1 binding site, but it's not liver specific. It's in fact specific for the, I think, intestine. So this is an example for, you know, where our method by construction is already doomed to fail, because we make the assumption that these four factors are involved, and those are in fact critical liver factors, but they can be involved in some of the tissues as well. So yeah, and let me also point a direction to this Nature Genetics paper that Wyeth wrote with Chip Lawrence and Michael Palumbo and Jim Fickett. You can access this number that shows you, it's a major motivation for this human mouse comparisons, looking for regulatory regions. We're using this program DBA to do cross species comparisons on these small scales. DBA is a program whose CPU expands scales as L squared when L is on the order of the sequences you're comparing. So this makes it immediately clear that you're in a very bad shape if you want to do a comparison on a genomic scale. So on a genomic scale, if you take your liver model and scan all the human data you have available, and then you take the results and you compare them against mouse, there's no way you can do it with DBA. So we did something similar, like something very similar to the pictures I just showed you, but using BLAST for the cross-species comparison. And this is just a short list of some examples of the kind of results we got. So we have the gene in the first column, and then we have the LRA scores we have gotten for human and rodent and human accession numbers and positions within the sequence. This is for those people who are interested in going into the details, and maybe experimentalists who get interested in looking some. And I'm going to be done in a few minutes, so this is all over very soon. This is the kind of information you have to have if you want to motivate experimentalists to look at a certain promoter region, or potential promoter region. And these are the corresponding data for rodent. And again, this is M as some mouse, R are rats, and just abbreviations for the species of the rodents we're looking at. There are four different classes here. The first one, the A, is some regulatory regions of our positive training set that we rediscovered using our method. We didn't find all of them. We had a total of 16 positive training sequences. We didn't find all of them for several reasons, because, for example, they might be not available in the rodent database if we use the human one as a positive training sequence, and things like that. The other ones are the B ones, are genes that we didn't have in our initial collection but that we found with our method. C is an example. There are just two examples for genes that are somewhat relevant for the liver, but not, you can call them liver specific. For example, this MYC6 that is also known as gene 33, that is not liver specific, but it is, it's been studied because it's upregulated by insulin. So that's what we like to call liver related. In some relation to liver specificity. And D are other genes, like this one is the one you've seen before with the HNF1 site, but not liver specific. This is one example that we can get hit real results, but they're not liver specific because they include the factors some of the factors we've used in some different way. Before,
is that gene expressed in the liver?
Which one? It's not expressed in the liver. HNF1 is involved in the regulation, though. What I did a few months ago was to set up a web server. It's not quite done yet, where you can paste in a sequence or submit a sequence, and then the liver model runs through it, and you can actually even choose this muscle-specific model that I referred to before to analyze it. And there are extensions that you can think of that you'd also do this phylogenetic footprinting along with this, that you submit two species and then you get a plot of two different things. And one thing I also have to improve is the name, because somehow when I just had needed a name for the file, for this HTML file, and I've chosen Transregio, and it somehow reminds one of, you know, these names trains have in Europe, like Interregio or something like that. So on the one hand, that gave me an excuse to put this picture I've taken near the Salt Lake Desert with a freight train running by on it. But on the other hand, I had to add a disclaimer that says that it has no relation whatsoever with SJ. Now, SJ is the Swedish equivalent of Amtrak. So maybe if somebody comes up with a flashy name, I will be happy to change this thing. And this will be made available. And the whole data set is, I mean, there are a few people whom I sent the data set in past, as many genes as we have together, with all the annotations and things that we use. So if anybody might be interested in using these kind of things, I would be more than happy to show you something. We already mentioned a little bit further improvements. One of them is to look at multiple binding sites. This is something I was planning to do with Tim Bailey in Stockholm. Now I'm essentially done there, so there will be, but maybe I continue this work with him. Look for multiple binding sites. Another thing that I usually mention when I talk to mainly biologists in the audience is that these different transcription factors have different roles in the development of the liver. In fact, HNF1 is mainly expressed in the adult or mature liver, whereas this one other factor that's involved, HNF3, is very important at early stages of the liver development. Now, the genes we're looking at, the genes that we took for our training sequences are genes that are all important in the mature liver, so we just can't expect HNF3 to have the same important role as the other factors. Now, as a next step, what we want to do is to look at multiple binding sites, because those will be important for HNF3, and also look at genes that are expressed at earlier stages of the liver. I'm curious how much of this work we'll be able to do. So, yeah, well, I'm pretty much done. Thanks a lot for your attention.